WNYC Studios is supported by Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. Protein degradation can target and destroy cancer-causing proteins right inside the cell. It's how Dana-Farber is working to treat previously untreatable cancers. Learn more at DanaFarber.org/everywhere. WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics Pre-Alcohol Probiotic Drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink, drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at ZBiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's ZBiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Thanks a lot for listening this morning. Coming up in about 15 or 20 minutes, the New York State Health Commissioner answers your questions about the Obamacare health exchanges, which are opening in New York and around the country today, government shutdown or no. But first, which will happen first, a deal on Iran's nuclear weapons or one to reopen the United States government? Our next guest is in a unique position to predict. He recently became the BBC's bureau chief in Washington after serving as their bureau chief in the Middle East. He is Paul Danahar and has a new book called The New Middle East, The World After the Arab Spring, which takes a step back from the fast-moving events in Egypt and Syria and elsewhere and puts them in the larger context of this really once-in-a-century historic set of changes sweeping the region, including the Arab Spring countries, as well as Iran and Israel and the United States. So hi, Paul. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you very much.
First, I'm reading your bio here. You just became the Americas Bureau Chief based in Washington.
That's right.
You were the Middle East Bureau Chief. And before that, the East Asia Bureau Chief. And at another time, the South Asia Bureau Chief.
Yeah, I'm running out of plots to go.
Is this how the BBC moves everyone around, or are you just a restless guy?
I just got lucky. The wars kept following me around, so it kept me busy. And then I moved on to another one. So I've had an interesting 15 or 16 years.
I guess so. And I really like the framing of your book, putting recent events in the big historical picture. Do you think this first conversation in 34 years between an American and an Iranian president is the result in any way of larger forces unleashed by the Arab Spring or separate from it?
I think it's a bit of a mix. I think the thing about the Iranians is they've had a crazy guy basically speaking for them for the last 8 years in Ahmadinejad. And the sanctions really were biting. And it was easy to apply sanctions because this guy just sounded nuts. And so they really, really suffered over the last 8 years. They had to get somebody else in. He didn't really represent the Iranian people. And at the end of it, he didn't represent the supreme leader either because they had a big battle. You even had al-Qaeda calling him a crazy conspiracy theorist. And when you have al-Qaeda saying that you're nuts, you really are in gray area there. So I think this is a mix of the tectonic changes that are going on in the Middle East with the changes within the uprisings and the competing between the Sunni and the Shia. But it's also about the simple policy action of America saying to everybody in the world, we have to apply sanctions and apply them in a tough way to Iran.
Now, before the Arab Spring revolts began in 2011, there were all these entrenched dictators and monarchs and other old-fashioned authoritarian governments, some like the Assads in Syria in their second generation. Why did that condition remain unbroken for so long? Everybody asks, well, why did it happen in 2011? I'm going to ask the opposite question. Why did it remain unbroken for so long when Asia and Latin America and Africa were all starting to democratize much more?
Because it worked for the West. I mean, if you look at the—
It worked for the West.
It worked for the West. So the West wasn't going to push anyone to make any changes. So, you know, the most important thing for American and Western foreign policy about the Middle East was oil and security for Israel. And originally the Cold War and the influence of the Soviets, and then it was about Islamic fundamentalism. And the dictators said, look, you stick with us, the oil supply will keep going, Israel won't get into any wars with anybody, and we'll keep a lid on the fundamentalists. And that worked. I mean, they had a phrase for it. It was called Arab exceptionalism. And it basically meant the Arabs shouldn't be given democracy because they don't know what to do with it. So let's just carry on as we are.
And but did the West really have that much power?
Well, it did in the sense that it kept propping these regimes up. I mean, there was no pressure for them to change. The guy who really did change it was George Bush. I mean, he tried to fashion an ideology out of 9/11, and he decided that democracy was what was going to change things and get rid of these Arab fundamentalists. And he pushed people. And I think what happened, particularly in, say, Egypt, was that it didn't work. The freedom agenda didn't work, but it did show how corrupt these regimes were. And it showed that to their people. And that gave a bit of a window, a crack in the door, and that's what began this process.
It's been politically incorrect, I think, even to ask that question. But you're right. President Bush always said the imposition of a democratic process, even through a U.S. invasion, was intended to unleash the thirst for democracy across the region, which would in theory wind up with empowered people who would therefore feel less inclined to join groups like Al-Qaeda. So their democracy and our safety became one in that theory. So do you think that seeing elections in Iraq, no matter how imperfect, helped inspire the Arab Spring?
No, I don't think it did. I mean, the thing about what happened in Iraq was it was an idea to promote democracy because all the other things fell apart. There were no chemical weapons, and that was the reason why the war was supposed to have taken place. So democracy promotion became the reason for it, the justification for what followed.
Chemical, biological, nuclear weapons.
Exactly.
And they didn't find them.
And they didn't find them. So therefore it became, well, look, we're bringing democracy. So it's not been a failure, really. You know, we've done something that's positive. But what that really did in the region was shift the balance of power between the Sunni and the Shia. It gave Saudi Arabia in particular a real wake-up call because suddenly they saw Iran having new influence in the region. They had influence in Afghanistan because of the end of the Taliban. They had influence in Iraq. And that began to change the whole dynamics in the region. And that scared people. The problem with the invasion in Iraq was that everybody knew Saddam was going to fall. I was in Iraq in 2002. I was there when the statue fell down. We were all preparing for after Saddam's fall. America wasn't. It didn't think that there was going to be any kind of confusion or chaos. They'd walk in, they'd get flowers thrown at them, and they'd leave. And so that toppling of the first dictator was really the beginning of the process of change in the Arab world.
This is WNYC FM HD and AM New York, WNJT FM 88.1 Trenton, WNJP 88.5 Sussex, WNJY 89.3 Netcon, and WNJO 90.3 Toms River, the stations of New York and New Jersey Public Radio. My guest right now is Paul Danahar, who is the author of The New Middle East, The World After the Arab Spring. He has been the Middle East Bureau Chief for the BBC. Now he's the Washington Bureau Chief. We can get a couple of questions in here if you want at 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or you can post a question for Paul at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehr Show. Egypt, big picture, the most iconic Arab Spring country in 2011. We've been watching the troubles with Morsi and now the army. Do you think this is all a transition to democracy or something less?
It was looking like it was on the right path. The problem was that after the first revolt in 2011, the secular, young, liberal people who led it didn't build anything afterwards. So when the army basically overthrew Mubarak, and then the army had a terrible first year where they just made mistake after mistake after mistake, that was when the young, secular liberals could have got their act together and offered an alternative. They didn't. So the Brotherhood just stepped in. Then they made a complete mess of it. And when they made a mess of it, there was still no alternative because no one had built anything to replace the two arms of Egypt, which was the government or the military and the Brotherhood. And so when the military said, well, look, you know, we'll get rid of this guy, they said, yeah, and they're back with a military regime again. So Egypt is a real disappointment because of all the places that are important in the Middle East, Egypt is the one. And if you can get it right there, that offers you an opportunity everywhere else, and they've really messed it up.
Do you think that the young secular liberals and other elites in Cairo were surprised after Mubarak fell how much rural Egyptians were interested in voting for a Muslim Brotherhood government?
I think that was true all over the Middle East. I mean, the problem with the Arab world was that the people living in the urban centers believe the world revolves around them. They forget about the poor in the rural areas who didn't get a vote, didn't get anything out of the state, but they did get support from the mosque. They did get support from the Muslim Brotherhood, which provided social services that the state failed to do. So it was kind of inevitable that they would vote for these people. But even some of the seculars voted for the Brotherhood because they couldn't bring themselves to vote for the army. And they were hugely disappointed. If you look at the results for the parliament, the Brotherhood got a massive support. When you looked at the presidential vote, they barely scraped through with a win. And that shows how much they disappointed people.
And I don't know if I want to make too much of the parallel, but here in America, we have a major political divide between Republican, religious right-leaning rural areas and Democrat liberal-leaning cities. I don't know if there's a parallel to that in the new Middle East.
I think there is, in the sense that you can't take religion out of the politics of the Middle East. And you can't really take religion out of the politics of America, because people don't present themselves in America as, you know, I don't believe in God, vote for me. I mean, it would be catastrophic. So I think, you know, religion is a part of people's lives, both in the Middle East and in America. And that does reflect the way that they look at their politics sometimes.
So on that, Americans, by and large, don't get the Sunni-Shiite rivalry, I think, which you write about at length. Iran is Shiite. Saudi Arabia is Sunni. They're rivals. Most Iraqis are Shiites, but Saddam Hussein was Sunni. Al-Qaeda is more Sunni. Is this really about a 7th century theological dispute, as we often hear, or is that a coincidence with which countries are jockeying for power in the region?
If you look at Christianity, you have the Catholics and the Protestants. And where I come from, in the UK, we had pretty much a kind of civil war going on in Northern Ireland, which was exactly the same. It was rooted in ancient history. But over time, the divisions within society and the complications within society led to violence. That's what's happened in the Middle East. It's always there, and often there's intermarrying. In Iraq, there was a lot of intermarrying between Sunni and Shia. But when it starts to go wrong, people look for someone to blame, and it's much easier to blame someone from a different faith or a different community or a different race. And that's why whenever things go bad in the Middle East, you get this Sunni-Shia divide flaring up again.
Would it be accurate to say that Sunni Saudi Arabia and Shiite Iran are the two major power brokers in the region and very competitive with each other?
Absolutely, and that's playing out in Syria. The one other, the new player in the game is Qatar, which is this kind of small state that basically, before the Arab Spring, went around giving money to everybody in the hope that somebody would be their friend. When the Arab Spring happened, the Saudis got a bit nervous because they were worried about their own Sunni-Shia divide. The Qataris thought, great, you know, let's try and win new friends. And they started throwing money everywhere. They threw it at the Muslim Brotherhood. They threw it at the rebels in Syria. And America was standing back at this stage. America didn't want to get involved. And it basically left Syria to be managed by the Gulf. And the Gulf's reaction to big problems is to open their wallets and throw money at it and hope that works it out. It didn't.
Is Qatar, which founded Al Jazeera and throws a lot of money at it still, I believe, increasing its power in the region through Al Jazeera, through the media, as opposed to some of the other military and economic means? Or is that irrelevant?
No, it had a big influence on the Middle East. Al Jazeera, particularly in the last decade, was hugely important. It began to get a bit undermined in the Arab Spring because, first of all, in Egypt, everyone was supporting the revolution, so that was fine. And then along came Libya. And there Qatar, the Qatari kind of television channel, which is Al Jazeera, was seen to be not only reporting on the war, but cheering on the war. And that caused people to say, hang on, what are the Qataris up to? They were putting arms in. They were putting men in. I mean, they were seen to be decisive in the final battle. So the Qataris are complicated. I should probably declare an interest here. At the moment, they're refusing to publish my book in Qatar.
Really?
Because they don't like what I've written about Qatar. So I ought to say that in case people think I'm just being spiteful. But I wrote these things before they tried to ban my book. But the Qataris are complicated. And they've been trying to overreach, I think, in the Middle East. The Saudis have begun pushing them back. The Americans have begun pushing them back. So it'd be interesting to see how the Gulf plays out.
That book, by the way, is The New Middle East, The World After the Arab Spring by Paul Danahar, our guest, the former Middle East Bureau Chief for the BBC from 2010 to 2013, now the Washington, D.C. Bureau Chief for the Beeb. You also write about Israel with its own growing divisions between secular and ultra-Orthodox, which we've talked about on this show and we'll discuss later this week with Israel's Deputy Defense Minister, who I believe is coming on. But I've thought that part of the Arab Spring that part of the Arab Spring revolt said, in effect, you authoritarian governments keep telling us Israel is our biggest problem, but we know that's a distraction. We don't like Israeli treatment of Palestinians. We don't love the fact that they're even there. But don't distract us with some great Jewish threat when our biggest oppressors are you. Is that an Arab Spring subtext you accept?
Yeah, I do. I think and what I think is important now is that there isn't really an Arab-Israeli conflict going on. It's an Israeli-Palestinian conflict because the Arab world has got too much to worry about the Palestinians. But there's always been a level of hypocrisy with the Arab leaders. They use the Palestinians as a stick to beat the Israelis. If they really wanted to do something about it, they could have done what they did in 1973, which was basically when America was seen to be siding with Israel in that war, they cut off the oil. The Arabs have never cut off the oil to defend the Palestinians. So you can see where the Palestinian cause is in their priorities. They weren't prepared to make life difficult for themselves to help the Palestinians. What you have now is basically Israel and the Palestinians as a problem on its own. And the Arabs will basically deal with it when they can be bothered, but it's not their top priority.
We're just about out of time. We have the New York State Health Commissioner, Dr. Nirav Shah, standing by to answer people's questions about Obamacare, which, of course, debuts today. And before you go, I wonder, to kind of make a transition to that, if you're also doing your day job as Washington Bureau Chief for the BBC, maybe you're just out on the book tour, so you're not paying so much attention, but are you reporting back to Brits what this government shutdown looks like?
Yeah, we are. And it's kind of fascinating for us because it doesn't happen like this anywhere in the world where you argue about paying your bills and you allow paying your bills to become a political issue. So there's a great deal of interest. It was our lead story last night on our main 10 o'clock news.
And do you think you're giving them a different angle than we're getting from our own press, which maybe by being so American doesn't see some of the forest for the trees?
I think for us it's more the idea that a country as big and important as America can get into this much of a mess. I mean, the idea that, you know, things just shut down is crazy to many Europeans. And the idea that people are willing to let their government shut down to make a political point is even more confusing. So I think our step back is slightly, what on earth is going on here? How does it happen?
Paul Danahar, former Mideast Bureau Chief for the BBC, now America's Bureau Chief based in Washington. I hope we can talk about both parts of the world many times. Thank you for coming on
Thanks
today.
Thanks very much for having
and
me.
And congratulations on the book, The New Middle East, The World After the Arab Spring. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And coming up next, we do have the New York State Health Commissioner, Dr. Nirav Shah, to answer your questions about day one of the Obamacare health exchanges being open. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Dr. Shah next. Stay with us.